I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Every morning, we awake to a world marvelously alive. Where do we encounter awe and wonder in this world? In animals and plants, in deserts, on mountains, in forests, ocean, and sky, in history, art, and science, in human striving and human kindness. Join us as we quest for the awe and wonder of knowing we are part of something infinitely larger than ourselves. A naturalist is someone who, through lots of study and hands-on experience, knows a whole lot about nature. In this episode of Constant Wonder, we'll visit with someone who has packed her entire life with such experiential learning in the natural world. But she herself is a natural at this kind of work. In her case, I wouldn't even call it second nature for her to function as a naturalist. It's first nature to her. Befriending and studying animals is an inborn disposition. And with that word, inborn, I mean truly innate. If anyone was born for this kind of work, it's Cy Montgomery. Cy is a longtime friend of our podcast. If you've listened in the past, you likely recall stories that she's told us about chickens or turtles or octopuses, all wonders in their own right. But when she came in person to our studio, I decided I wanted to learn most of all, if possible, what is it that makes Cy herself a wonder, given her lifelong passion and personal investment in animals and earth care? Cy has published prolifically. Here are just a few of my favorite titles. The Hummingbird's Gift, How to Be a Good Creature, Of Time and Turtles, Mending the World Shell by Shattered Shell, and books for children, including Condor Comeback, The Magnificent Migration on Safari with Africa's Last Great Herds, and Temple Grandin, How the Girl Who Loved Cows Embraced Autism and Changed the World. It was an honor to sit down with Cy Montgomery recently, and I'm eager to share our conversation with you. Cy, I'm so glad you could come.
Oh, I couldn't come to Utah and not see you.
Thank you for coming to our studios. Today, I thought it would be great to get to know you as well as animals. I know you're on a book tour. A wonderful book for children, The True and Lucky Life of a Turtle. But we want to find out your story because your career, your life, has been so dedicated to the animal kingdom in particular. Can we start with childhood?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't remember a lot of my childhood, but my parents told me. They took me to the Frankfurt Zoo. I was born in Germany. I was less than 2 years old. And as a toddler, I broke free of my parents' hands. And when they next saw me, I was in the hippo pen with the hippos. I don't think my mother ever got over that, but the hippos were fine, and I was fine. And I clearly felt like I was with my people. I wasn't at all afraid, and I also wasn't wiggling around and freaking them out. So when I began to talk, I told my parents that my big problem was that everyone wanted me to grow up to be a little girl, and I wasn't actually a little girl. I was a horse. And my mother was horrified again, went to the pediatrician, and he assured her I would grow out of it, which I did when I discovered I was actually a dog. Again, here's my problem. Everyone is so interested in helping me be a little girl, and I have no interest in this. I need a dog to help me be a dog.
Did you see yourself as different from other children in this regard?
Totally. In fact, I was sent home from my first day of kindergarten because I bit a little boy. He was pulling the legs off a daddy long legs.
Unforgivable in your eyes?
Well, you know how we ask each other, you know, what would Jesus do? I often ask myself, what would Molly do? Because she was the dog that my parents got me, a Scottish Terrier, when I was little. And if she saw injustice, she bit. So I would too.
this is actually emulating the behaviors and maybe even the values of animals, if animals could be said to have values.
Well, they certainly do. Goodness. Yeah. She was the adored older sister that I might have wished for. I didn't want to have an older sister who was like putting on false eyelashes and wearing go-go boots or that kind of thing. I wanted an older sister who could run really fast and who could see in the dark and whose tall ears could pick up sounds that people couldn't hear. Someone who was fierce and feral and fearless. And that was Molly.
How big was she?
Scotty's, they are, gosh, what do you think she weighed?
The better question would be, how big were you compared to her?
Well, this is the interesting thing. I guess I was maybe 3 or something, or 4. Again, I don't remember a lot of my childhood. I had a head injury, and everyone who remembers me as a child is now dead. But I sure do remember what my parents told me. And Molly, even though she was younger than me, because she was a puppy and I had been born a couple of years earlier, I recognized even as a child that she was more mature. Dogs do mature more rapidly than children. So, you know, in a few years, a dog is an adult. A child takes, well, 18 years if you look at the point at which you're allowed to vote.
Were you being so observant that you were taking cues from Molly?
I wanted to know what she did. And to her credit, I mean, people today will tell you generally you shouldn't give a Scottish Terrier to a small child because small children will wiggle around and that annoys some breeds more than others. And Scotties will tell you when they're unhappy. They are pretty fierce. They think they're much bigger dogs than they are. Their teeth are the size of that of an Airedale. And it's not that she bit a whole lot of people, but I knew she was also strong and fast and just supremely competent. And I was a little girl being forced to dress in stupid Mary Janes and little lacy socks and dumb dresses, but she wasn't. And that was back in the days when you would let your dog out at night and they would run around and meet other dogs and do dog stuff, and then they would come back. Today you can't do that. Your dog would be hit by a car, some horrible thing would happen. But I was very aware that she was out doing grown-up dog stuff.
I have to ask you this, and I don't want to make too much of this either, but the fact that this kind of set you apart from whatever might be deemed to be normative childhood behavior, that can be hard. That can be hard to feel different from other kids your age.
Well, you don't know any different. I was an only child. My father was a brigadier general most of my life. And if you were the general's daughter and you're living on base, no one on base wants their kids to play with you. Because what if they bean you over the head with their little plastic truck? Your dad's doing KP for the rest of his life, as they might fear. I went to a private school that was far, far away. So any children who I might have made friends with at school, I wasn't playing with them in, you know, the afternoons. I had other friends.
I
had bees, and I had a parakeet named Jerry, and I had lizards, those anole lizards, a whole series of them, all named Lizzie. And I loved watching ants, and I loved watching birds, and I knew how to stay still. And again, this might have been because of head injury, but I'm so old. I was brought up in the era in which children's portraits were painted. My parents had me sit for 2 portraits as a toddler, and I stayed perfectly still for hours because they burned a candle, and I watched the flame.
Self-awareness comes to people at different ages. Was there a time, was it in adolescence, was it in young adulthood, when you kind of had a self-concept that congealed in such a way that you saw yourself as a person who for life would be like this?
I didn't have a sudden awakening, but learning to read was a huge thing for me. I remember my father, we moved around a lot as we were military, but the first 4 years of grade school, we lived at Fort Hamilton in Brooklyn, New York. and the newspaper that you read was the New York Times. I was born in 1958, so I'm reading the New York Times in the 1960s. I love animals, so my father is helping me learn to read the newspaper by reading all the stories about animals. And what were all the stories about animals about in the New York Times in the 1960s? How they were going extinct.
Yeah.
And why were they going extinct? They were going extinct because of us, because of our pollution, because of our overhunting, because our homes and roads and factories and cars were overrunning their land. Because there's so many of us.
This isn't all that many years after Rachel Carson and Silent Spring. And so I would imagine that public awareness during this era, late 50s into the 60s, heightened awareness.
Yes. And the New York Times is reporting on this. And I knew about extinction because for the longest time I was in love with dinosaurs. I still am. Because, of course, they're now birds. So
that takes us to your chicken book, probably.
right. Well, I was devastated as a child to learn that the dinosaurs had gone extinct. So I knew what extinction was. But the thought that elephants could become extinct, that whales could become extinct, that gorillas and chimpanzees who looked so like us and behaved so like us could become extinct, this upset me tremendously as a child. And I'd always felt like what I wanted to do in my life was to help animals and be with animals. And I thought maybe I'd be a veterinarian, although even then, women didn't really become veterinarians. But I never really paid attention to the fact I was, my gender didn't particularly concern me or limit me ever. I just thought, just because Jacques Cousteau was a guy, I didn't think, well, I can't go scuba diving. Of course I could. And remember, Jane Goodall went into the field in 1960, and the National Geographic magazines that I was looking at before I could even read were showing this young ponytailed blonde girl kneeling down on the African soil, reaching her arm out towards a chimpanzee who was reaching his arm out to her. So all of this is going into my brain. I knew this was where I belonged among all the creatures, and I hoped that if I paid enough attention to Molly, she would help teach me the secrets of the wild animals.
As you're going through elementary school and then into high school, are you finding enough in the schools to start learning about it systematically, about biology?
I liked writing and I liked reading, so I would go to the library. The library was the center of the universe for me, and I would check out books on any animal, any landscape, plants. That's what I just loved to read, and I loved to write my own stories. And over the summer, I would just do, not that it was an assignment, I would just spontaneously do book reports and spontaneously write stories that I would make up. I knew they were fiction, but one was, living underwater. I created a newspaper with a circulation of three, my father, my mother, and me, called The Daily Happenings, and wrote about the daily happenings. Mostly they were about how my father was the best man in the world. But and the comings and goings of various animals and Molly, of course, and my parakeet Jerry. But when I began to discover books and newspapers and magazines and the power of reading, that's when I began to think, I like writing. Animals are in trouble because of people. If I write, that might even help more animals than even if I was a veterinarian. So pretty early on, I decided that would be what I would do.
About what age are you doing these kinds of writings, the happenings?
Oh, this is like first, second, third, fourth grade. Okay, yeah, okay. That kind of stuff.
Yeah. By the time you get to college, writing is like that's in your back pocket. That's something you're doing a lot of.
Yes. I went to Syracuse University because they had a daily student-run newspaper that was the best way I could have possibly prepared for writing books, which seems crazy because, the newspaper, you're writing it really fast. It's going to be on the bottom of the birdcage tomorrow. And it seems so different from writing a book.
Yeah.
But the skills that I learned as a writer, asking like what you do, Marcus, all the details that make something vivid and make it come alive, all the things that you want to share with the people you love, and beyond that, the people you haven't met but you already love because you're writing for them.
But did you get to write the things you wanted to write about animals, or were you given a beat? Did you have to go down and do like...
You've got to do a beat. But it's just like, you know, you work in college to make some money as a waitress. It doesn't matter that you're going to be an astronaut.
But I'm wondering if the whole time you were saying to yourself, I got to get out of this so I can write about the animals.
Well, I was finding a way to make this work. When I got out of school, when I graduated from Syracuse University, I wanted to work for a newspaper in New Jersey because New Jersey had the highest number of scientists and engineers per capita. I wanted my beat to be science, the environment, and medicine so I could cover these issues. It wasn't that I wanted to do this for the rest of my life, but it was a good stepping stone for the next thing that would come. And after I had worked for the Courier News for 5 years, my father, bless his heart, gave me the gift of a ticket to Australia on vacation, where I always wanted to go. And I didn't just want to vacation. I wanted to learn and I wanted to give back. And I found out about this organization called Earthwatch. It still exists and it pairs paying laymen with scientific and conservation projects around the world. It's tailored to a working person who only has a couple of weeks a year. You can't just quit and join the science team, but you can work there for a couple of weeks. Yeah. So I found out about Dr. Pamela Parker's work with the southern hairy-nosed wombat in Blanchetown, South Australia.
You liked saying that. Say it one more time. You really relished being able to say that name, didn't you? The southern
hairy-nosed wombat. Very different from the common wombat. Even more special than the common wombat, who is himself very special. And during those 2 weeks, we lived in tents and we cooked over campfires, and by day we were out with the animals and kangaroos bouncing like balls everywhere, and the sunsets covered with parrots, and the wombats were fascinating. Most of their lives take place underground, so they're very secretive. I loved it so much, and Dr. Parker said to me at the end of the 2 weeks, I can see you're just on fire to do this kind of work.
I can hear that you're on fire, or that you were on. So was this an epiphany?
What she said was, I'd love to hire you, but I have no money, so I can't. I'd love to give you money so you could come back next year and assist, but I don't have money for that either. She said, but if you ever wanted to study anything on your own, I would give you food, and you could stay at my camp. So I went and quit my job and got a tent and moved to the outback and lived there for 6 months and studied emus.
I forgot to ask Sai about this little detail, but presumably Dr. Parker made good on the promise to provide her food. In just a moment, the story continues of Sai upending her life by leaving her job of 5 years as a news writer in order to engage in wildlife research down under. And what about those emus, birds that can be 6 feet tall? Our guest in this episode is prolific nature writer and passionate spokesperson for animals, Sai Montgomery. She's been with us several times previously on Constant Wonder, most recently talking about turtle rescue. Be sure to give that a listen sometime too. It's Season 7, Episode 3. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. I've worked with lots of younger kids, including my own, and I know firsthand the great feeling of finding just the right kind of educational listening for younger folk. We've got a podcast perfectly suited for younger hearts and minds. It's the Constant Wonder Kids podcast. Stories from the original Constant Wonder podcast featured in a way that's totally accessible for children from about kindergarten age until they hit middle school. Many of these episodes are adventure stories out in nature with fascinating people who go out into the wide world to see its wonder and awe. Curious, developing kids love this podcast, as well as the grown-ups who guide and love these kids. True stories about ocean divers, bird scientists, volcanologists, non-experts who rescue animals and rewild and replant damaged habitats. Positive stories about people doing positive things for the world. Would you like to get inside the mind of a bee, or find tiny hummingbird eggs, or go in search of seahorses? Maybe discover amazing ways that some plants can think and communicate. Constant Wonder Kids is perfect for road trips, bedtime listening, maybe just for whenever your brain's got an itch that needs to be scratched. New episodes drop on Mondays. Tune in to Constant Wonder Kids on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to Constant Wonder. Quitting your job to go live in a tent and study emus in Australia for half a year. Sigh, that is a huge commitment. I would call it very gutsy. I would not have been so adventurous. I'm a timid person by nature.
I'm not sure that's true.
I do not stick my neck out very far, very often. I mean, this is pivotal.
But I knew. I mean, everyone was saying I was crazy. My parents thought I was crazy. Everyone except my future husband, Howard Mansfield. He encouraged me to go. And I had a really good job. I mean, I had a peach of a job, and I was appreciated, and I was doing meaningful work. It wasn't like I didn't like what I was doing and had to escape.
So was this thing in Australia still with wombats?
Well, the conservation park, which is about 2 hours from the city of Adelaide, has all kinds of wonderful animals on it. And when I left, I did not know what I would study. I had no idea. But, you know, if you throw yourself at the feet of your guides, who are the animals, I was confident something would materialize, that luck would find me. And one day I was out alone collecting some plants, helping a graduate student who needed some plants collected for a nitrogen study, and she'd sent me out with a bunch of paper bags to do a transect. I looked up. I didn't hear a sound, but you know when someone is watching? Well, I looked up. And three birds, each taller than a man, with tiny wing stumps, were walking right by me. It was as if angels had appeared from heaven before me. I was transfixed by their balletic beauty, by their strangeness. These animals, their feathers look like hair. They are these stringy, double-shafted feathers that hang off their body. They look like kind of walking brown haystacks with black periscope.
Walking brown haystacks.
They do. They have these tall, black, periscope-like necks and beaks that sort of look like a goose beak. But these huge things, they didn't look like birds you saw in the United States. And I thought, wow, I want to study these guys. And I thought at first, you know, how am I going to study them? Will I ever even see them again? Well, I noticed one of them had pooped, and there was a bunch of seeds in their poop, and it was quite distinctive. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I can find out what they eat and how this affects the vegetation if I just find their poop. But I kept finding the birds, and I kept approaching them until they were uncomfortable and then stopping. And every day I wore the same thing so they could easily recognize me. And every day, my presence told them, I'm not going to hurt you. I'm not going to scare you. Because Jane Goodall was my heroine. And that is how she had approached the chimpanzees of Gombe. She didn't stalk after them when they didn't want to be seen. She sat out on that special place called the Peak and let the apes see her and get used to her. And then gradually got closer and closer until she could be among them.
So you didn't know that methodology from Jane Goodall
before
you did your little trick.
Yes. And then I did the same with these birds. And this was at a time when the intelligence of birds was something a lot of scientists did not understand. They thought, bird brains, you know. Even though the emu stands beside the kangaroo as on the coat of arms of Australia, no one had done a study just finding out, what do they do all day? Where do they go? What do they do? How much time do they spend feeding? How often do they drink? Are they sitting? Are they standing? Are they sleeping? When they sleep, are their necks under their little tiny 8-inch wing stuff? No one knew the most basic stuff about them. So I just followed them all day long.
And documented it.
I didn't discover anything like tool use, which is what Jane Goodall discovered, just blew the whole world open for ethology. It turns out now that not only do chimpanzees use tools, there are fish and insects who use tools. It is widespread.
Ravens,
in the animal.
Crows?
Absolutely. I think a raven or crow could probably open that bottle of water. I couldn't do. But yeah, it's quite widespread. But before, it was thought that only humans used tools, and this is what distinguished us from the rest of animate creation.
Do you ever tell this story to children and try to encourage them to take notes of what they're observing?
Yeah, I do. I do. And I get questions from kids, too, about, you know, what could I study? What could I find out that's new? And the fact that I was studying an animal that was so well known in Australia, it was on the bloody coat of arms, but no one had studied them just doing what they're
big
doing
gap.
All day.
Really big gap. There.
Enormous. Same thing is true of so many other animals. People have studied squirrels, but it turns out squirrels in this part of the country probably behave totally different from squirrels in that part of the country, and they have a different culture. So you could do a study of squirrels in your backyard, and you might find out something no one has ever seen.
We had a guest named Steve Peck. He's a professor here at the university, and he one day decided, well, where do these birds go, and what do they do at night? Mm-hmm. And he started doing what you did. He became observant. He went out with special, I think, infrared sensors, and he found out that the very birds, he didn't know where do they go at night? They went to a tree right up against his house and were right there all night long, right where he lived.
Wow.
And it was like a revelation to him.
It is a revelation. Animals are such a revelation. They are, as Henry Beston said, other nations. They're living right beside us. And they're living in our world, but experiencing our world through different senses with different powers. And once you start to understand their world, it expands your world. And it enormously expands your capacity for wonder and for compassion. And I think it makes us better creatures.
What you're talking about right here is kind of trademark Cy Montgomery, where you can talk about compassion, understanding, and caring. And it all began with observing, with your attentiveness. And I'm really sold on the idea that the real awe, the real wonder, is so highly attentive to the other creature that we lose ourselves.
And yes, we, and join something larger.
One of the things I've noticed about you, Cy, as I've followed your books, is that you have this habit. You didn't go down the road of going to the university and getting a PhD and learning to be, you know, an entomologist or whatever, an ornithologist. You stuck with the writing. But even in that writing, you never divorced yourself from participation in the work. And so when you're looking at hummingbirds, you go and get involved. When you're looking at turtles, you go and get involved. With the octopus, you're there. Is that just you being you? Is that a trick to make you a better writer? Is it you can't stop yourself? What is it?
I am following my bliss is what I'm doing. And also one of the things that Jane Goodall and her scientific sisterhood, Diane Fossey, who studied mountain gorillas, and Birute Galdikas, who went to study orangutans, what they showed me, and my first book was about those three women, and it was essentially a biography of their relationships with their study animals. So what they showed me is that, yes, we need to bring our intellect to the study of other creatures and to our work. We also not only can, but probably should, bring our intuition and emotion, bring our hearts.
People used to always say, I'd be interviewing them and they would say, well, I don't want to anthropomorphize. And they say, and yet I do a little bit. You know, they kind of hedge a little. I think it's perfectly healthy. Why not use two or three or five lenses on animals? And one of them could be your emotion.
I totally agree. And genetics tell us that we share 90% of our genetic material with all placental mammals. And genetics also tell us that we share 40% of our genetic material with a banana. The Bible tells us that we're all one family, that we were all made by one creator. This is the same story that cultures all over the world tell. We feel intuitively that we are part of a family.
Yeah, it gets knocked out of us.
It does. And I think it happens when children buy the lie that life is all about making a whole lot of money and driving a fancy car and having, you know, the right clothes and the right hair and the right, which is crazy because every wise man and wise woman throughout the history of the earth has told us that's the wrong way.
Yeah. My way of putting this has for many years now been that you can divide the world into two kinds of people, right? And what you have is the people who divide the world into two kinds of people and the people who never do that. No, what you really have is you have people who think the world is a theme park for our amusement, or people who think it might be a holy space, a holy temple where things are alive and possibly flourishing if we love and care for them and see them as sacred.
That's the camp that I live in.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think if you look at having actual joy in your life, waking up in a theme park is fun. But waking up in a world that's alive, that is a miracle, that is sacred and is holy, that's so much more than just fun.
I want to go back to extinction for a bit. As you were talking about extinction and you're becoming aware of that when you were very young, it reminded me when I was about 12, 13, 14, I started loving whales. I grew up in Southern California on the coast, San Diego, and I had opportunity to go out. And I would get out the encyclopedias. Blue whales were my favorite. And one day I heard that they were extinct. And for years, I lived believing that blue whales were extinct. I was a grown man before I was disabused of that notion.
Oh, my gosh.
I still remember just how gobsmacked I was to find out that something that I had mourned for was alive.
Hmm.
In recent years, we've seen the northern white rhino, I think, the very last living creature of that species, die. Do you have any advice for me about how to kind of go through life watching these tragedies?
Boy, do something about it. That's the only thing that helps. When I was working at the turtle rescue, it was during COVID. We didn't know what this strange contagion was. We didn't know if it would take us or the ones we loved. And it took from me two people I did love, including my falconry instructor. And our country was so divided. Environmental catastrophe was everywhere. I mean, California was on fire. The Amazon was on fire. Australia was on fire. Literally on fire. It was so easy to despair. But every day, I was helping to repair broken shells. I was literally mending the world. The concept that's known in Jewish mysticism as tikkun, putting the world, the broken world, back together. And there is nothing that can give you more joy and hope and get you past anything than helping to mend the world in even a small way. And Marcus, you are doing that with your life every day because you are reaching out to people and kindling that wonder that inspires us to care for creation.
The fact that we can do this in very small and incremental ways, I think it's just grossly, well, people, oh, I love this verb, people misunderestimate what we can really do.
That's a great word.
In my yard, I take great delight when I plant a flower, Palmer penstemon, and in the springtime, I see hordes of bumblebees come. And just in the flowers, in the mornings, to see that, I think I've done something. I've really done something more than mow a lawn, you know.
And you can do that every day. You can do something like that every day. Every time you go to the grocery store and you say, no, I'm not going to take those plastic bags because I know they choke sea turtles and they strand, they destroy all kinds of animals. Instead, I'll bring my own. Every day when you get in your car, you kind of picked a car that gets better mileage. When you go to vote, this makes a difference. Everything you do, washing your clothes and drying them on the line. We have so many opportunities to grab that chance to do something.
So if you are washing your clothes and putting them on the line, do you do that begrudgingly at all?
No, or? You do it joyously because instead
I'm talking
of
about you. Oh. Do you? I know the answer because you just gave it to me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, then your clothes smell like the outside. They smell like the air. They smell great. And instead of, they smell like the dryer. Wouldn't you rather smell like the outside? So the fun thing is, I mean, every single thing that I have done ostensibly to try to conserve the world has turned right around and blessed me instantly. Just one example, and not everybody is going to do this, but it's one of the things you can do. I read the book Animal Liberation in like 1980 and closed the book and never ate meat again. Everyone said, you're going to die because you're not going to get enough protein and you're going to be... No, we now know that that is like the healthiest thing you can do for your body. And I'm 67 years old and I am scuba diving to 110 feet. I can hike up into the cloud forest of Papua New Guinea. I can do everything with my vegetable-fed body. But when I first did it, I thought, oh, this is going to be hard. And I loved meat. I loved the taste of meat. It was great, but I just couldn't do it. And same thing with hanging your clothes out. Same thing with, you just feel joyous working at the turtle rescue, you know, instead of feeling hopeless.
I think the joy probably comes when you can make the connection or you connect the dots and you say, by doing X, here's the consequence and it's a healthy, good one. And then you can smile. You're not feeling guilt. You're not feeling shame.
No, you feel free. You feel like you're doing something to make a difference. That's the one thing I think that we can do is take a hand in mending the world. And this is what all the great wise men and women have been telling us all along.
I want to come back in just a moment to this theme of mending the world. By the way, I love that Jewish phrase that you shared with us, tikkun olam, mending the world. And you've been lending your voice for a kind of compassion that people can take on. It's a compassion that has a character, I would say, of reverence, of sanctity. And you model that for what you do for the natural world. That's where I basically am hoping our conversation can go next, Cy. Cy Montgomery visiting with us right now in this episode of Constant Wonder, and I'm Marcus Smith. It's a pleasure in this episode to have Cy Montgomery with us, a prolific writer about creation, about animals, about nature. I'm going to toss out that word now, Cy, creation, and chew on that for a while. It just so happens that today, as we are visiting, this is October 3rd. Who knows when people will listen to it? It might be in a year or two. But today is the day before the 4th, which is the feast day of St. Francis. This is a day when in the Catholic tradition, many people will be taking their pets to have them blessed. It also happens to be the conclusion of what in recent decades has become something called either Creationtide or the season of creation. I'll give you a little bit of background here, not too much, but the ecumenical patriarch Demetrios, who died in 91, this is the Eastern Orthodox Church, he established what was initially the Orthodox Day of Prayer for Creation, and that was September the 1st. And then after that, the World Council of Churches said, well, let's extend this over a season all the way to St. Francis. So you have a month plus 4 days of this season of creation. And then during all of this, it just so happens this year and last week, Pope Leo met in a big conference and he was commemorating with the Laudato Si group. That's Si with an S-I, not you. It's praise be to Cy Montgomery too. But he was commemorating the 10-year anniversary of that papal encyclical that Francis issued, Laudato Si, that has to do with creation care. All of these things converging in my mind in such a beautiful way to have you here. And I'm thinking now about the notion again of the holy and the sacred. You grew up in the Methodist tradition. You've read the Bible. You've said that you're still active at reading these kinds of religious texts. I adore Holy Scripture that turns to creation. That includes plants, that includes animals, that includes mountains and rivers and streams, that the fowl of the air, the fish of the seas, and whatsoever passeth through the paths of the seas, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth. Those kinds of verses, almost, I don't have words for it.
Well, those same verses spoke to me when I began to read the Bible, when I was going to Sunday school. They made me feel close to God. They made me understand that this is His creation. And how do you honor the Creator? Sometimes you can't see Him. You know, He's not sitting in front of you like you are. But His creation is everywhere. That's His glory, the glory of what so many other cultures also call God. In Hinduism, I've spent a lot of time in India, they are actually monotheistic. It's a monotheistic religion, but they have names, different names for God, and they have different images showing what God can do. Sometimes God is a lady with a bunch of arms sitting on a tiger, and sometimes He's an elephant-headed god, and sometimes He's a blue-skinned god floating on the ocean, but it's always the same God. So I think one of the best ways that we can connect with God, that we can praise God, that we can feel His holiness is to revel in, to glorify, to protect and to restore His creation.
You pulled in the Jewish tradition earlier too when you were talking about mending. And I think that within the Christian tradition, of course, your background in being Methodist, my background as a Latter-day Saint, I start looking about just the vast, long history of the Christian tradition, going back to St. Francis again with his sermon to the birds, St. Anthony preaching to the fish. This is not window dressing on a religion. This seems to be right at the heart of reverence for God.
Yes. Well, the first thing Genesis wants us to know isn't about people. That wasn't the first thing the Holy of Holies created.
Do you know the book of Job?
Oh, yeah.
They talk about a few animals there.
Downer,
you know?
Man, though.
Well, I found a new translation. One of my colleagues, Heather Bigley, she's involved in a couple of podcasts here from BYU Radio. She brought me this translation by Stephen Mitchell of the book of Job, and I was looking at it. Towards the end, Job gets this tremendous scolding from God, and God goes through quite a litany of creatures and kind of examines Job. What do you even do? What do you know about these things? Do you hunt game for the lioness and feed her cubs? They're hungry. They're crouching. Do you tell the antelope how to have their babies, Job? Do you do that? Do you deck the ostrich wings with its feathers, its elegant plumes? Do you give the horses strength? Can you catch a whale with a fish hook? He's kind of mocking Job for a kind of presumptuousness. I believe, Cy, and I don't want to scare people away from constant wonder. I don't want them to think that I'm, you know, one of those evil, mean, nasty preachers who's complaining, a crotchety one, you know. But I think that we've moved so far away from Scripture, from texts, from traditions that celebrate the flourishing of life that we have a big problem.
Yeah.
Was I crotchety there?
No,
I'm so sorry.
Not crotchety. You're calling it like you see it, and that's the way it is. That's the problem when we go wrong.
Have you followed the idea that within certain faith traditions, there might be a return to not worshiping creation, but worshiping God for creation? Have you?
Yes, totally, totally. Well, creation care was a big thing even in the Methodist Church. It's been for years, and that makes total sense to me. As a creative person, if somebody like took my book and spat on it and stabbed it with a knife, I would feel terrible. And I think we're spitting in the face of God if we pollute the rivers, if we extinguish whole kinds of creatures. It is such an obvious connection. that we have with the rest of creation and our desire to tell ourselves the lie that only humans matter is crazy. And scripture doesn't support it. Genetics doesn't support it. Evolution doesn't support it. Nothing supports it except our desire to be selfish. But selfishness doesn't bring us happiness. So that doesn't go anywhere anyway.
We talked about incremental things we can do. We talked about the small things we can do. We talked about being involved. As you go from day to day and you do your best to help the creatures, to teach children about helping creatures, to educate people about what is needed for not just individual animals, but for complex systems and ecosystems and the synergies between plants and animals and minerals, whatever is created. As you do that, is there ritual for you? Is there prayer for you in these actions? Is there something akin to ritual or prayer in these actions?
Well, it's been said that attention is a form of prayer. Paying attention to what has been created is pleasing to the Creator, and that makes total sense to me. There's a saying that's attributed to Thales of Miletus, who's the pre-Socratic Greek philosopher, that kind of names how I feel living in this world. And he's reported to have said, "The universe is alive and has fire in it and is full of gods." And of course, what he was saying was not, "Hey, let's all, you know, abandon monotheism." What he was saying was, this world is so alive, so animate, so full of souls, of creatures who love their lives like we love ours. It is so glorious, it's almost on fire. It is incandescent with life. And full of gods, that to me says that the world is itself holy and sacred, and we should walk through it in awe. I spend so much time in the woods every day, and it just fills up my soul. And when I ask my human and canine friends to join me in the woods, it's joyous for them too. It's a cycle that just fills you up over and over and over again. And when you ask someone to join you in something that you love, that's fun for everybody. It's fulfilling for everybody. It feels absolutely right. And no matter what else is going on in your day, having that time outside, listening to birds or listening to water, just seeing the snow cover the land or watching the plants wake up in the spring, that renewal, that lets you touch eternity. You don't feel alone. You don't feel powerless. You feel part of a big, strong, beautiful family. And that's what I hope to invite everyone I know to do with me.
Sai, such an honor and a pleasure to have you with us. I've just enjoyed this so much. Thank you for coming.
Oh, such a joy to be with you. And what a beautiful part of the world you live in.
It truly is. Sai Montgomery is a naturalist, an author, a script writer who writes for children as well as adults. She can often be heard speaking at museums, libraries, schools, universities. Her most recent publication is a picture book titled The True and Lucky Life of a Turtle. A great place to learn about her and find her amazing output of books about the various wonders of creation, books for children as well as grown-ups, is her website, symontgomery.com. That's symontgomery.com. Be sure to tell people you know and love about the value of constant wonder in your life and theirs, as well as the benefit of listening to this, the Constant Wonder Podcast. We are available on all the major platforms. We'd love to hear from you anytime by email with your feedback. Write to us, constantwonder@byu.edu. This episode was produced by Tenery Taylor and Mamie Teeples, with assistance given by Trent Reimschissel. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio. I've worked with lots of younger kids, including my own, and I know firsthand the great feeling of finding just the right kind of educational listening for younger folk. We've got a podcast perfectly suited for younger hearts and minds. It's the Constant Wonder Kids podcast. Stories from the original Constant Wonder podcast featured in a way that's totally accessible for children from about kindergarten age until they hit middle school. Many of these episodes are adventure stories out in nature with fascinating people who go out into the wide world to see its wonder and awe. Curious, developing kids love this podcast, as well as the grown-ups who guide and love these kids. True stories about ocean divers, bird scientists, volcanologists, non-experts who rescue animals and rewild and replant damaged habitats. Positive stories about people doing positive things for the world. Would you like to get inside the mind of a bee, or find tiny hummingbird eggs, or go in search of seahorses? Maybe discover amazing ways that some plants can think and communicate. Constant Wonder Kids is perfect for road trips, bedtime listening, maybe just for whenever your brain's got an itch that needs to be scratched. New episodes drop on Mondays. Tune in to Constant Wonder Kids on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.